Today's podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Expert Institute. If you handle cases involving lots of experts, I encourage you to talk to the Expert Institute. Let me give you an example of how that works for us at our firm. Let's say we need an expert for a case, say an expert in neurointensive care. In the old days, I would search my files for experts I'd used in the past, or maybe reach out to my colleagues at my firm or on a listserv for suggestions. Then our office would have to track these folks down, and perhaps the first person or two we contacted wouldn't work out and we'd go back to the drawing board. It takes time and resources. It can be inefficient and doesn't always land you with the best expert for your case. What do I do now? I simply send one email to my contact at the Expert Institute. We then have a brief call where I explain what I'm looking for, and they do all the work after that. And they don't just recycle the same old tired experts. Every search is unique and independently tailored for my case. It's tailored by the specialty of the expert, by geographic location, if I have a preference, and even by the amount of litigation experience that the person has. If I want somebody who's never testified in a case before, they will find me that person. And if I ask them to do so, they will locate several potential experts for a case and then set up all the phone calls for me so that I can interview those candidates and decide who will be the best fit for my case. It's faster, it's more efficient, and it produces better results. For our listeners only, Expert Institute is offering 25% off your first expert case consult. Go to expertinstitute.com/elevate, E-L-A-W-V-A-T-E, to redeem this exclusive discount. Our episode today is being sponsored by Smart Advocate. I run a complex personal injury and medical malpractice law firm. It's highly document intensive with hundreds and thousands of clients and files, and we manage our entire practice using Smart Advocate. It's really great. And one thing that's great about it is it's completely customizable. It has robust reports and dashboards to track all of your case and firm operational details, and it makes my firm more efficient and more profitable. The system features tools such as intake scoring, work plans, automated procedures, a new case wizard, and lots of other features that help your team manage your cases as efficiently as possible. With a responsive support team, continual software releases. In fact, they just upgraded their cloud-based software, which is what we use and is great because you can use it anywhere at home or at the office or anywhere on the road. Smart Advocate provides a legal case management software solution to help your firm. If you're interested in working with Smart Advocate, go to smartadvocate.com. And when you talk to them, tell them that folks at Elevate sent you and you'll get a discount only for our listeners.
This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. My name is Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon.
And Ben, we've got Sonia Chopra here today, but before we bring her on, she's a jury consultant, and I've worked with her in the past, and probably for the last 10 years on every jury trial that I've had, we've worked together. What's your experience with jury consultants, if any?
I've had limited experience with jury consultants. I hired one in a case to evaluate a series of focus groups that I did, and I found that to be really helpful. I've actually tried jury trials where the other side has had jury consultants there to help them pick the jury, and I did not. I always wondered whether that added value, particularly based on the outcome of the trials. But I'm very interested in it. I'm very interested in learning more about what Sonia does. And I just put one thing out there, and we can get to it later. But in our state, we don't have very wide-ranging voir dire opportunity. So I wonder how you could help us and other people that are in states where they don't have much opportunity for lawyer-directed voir dire.
So Sonia, welcome. Just a little bit of background. Sonia and I obviously have worked together for over 10 years. I feel like we have more of a brother-sister relationship over time.
Definitely.
We have our own true friendship. And so it's definitely a professional relationship, but it is a familial relationship more so in my mind. So I apologize in advance if we go straight into brother-sister talk every once in a while and just start laughing about inside jokes. But Sonia, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So touching upon what Ben said, you know, fact or fiction, science fiction, can you just tell everybody what the science is behind jury consulting?
Most people come into the profession from either a psychology or a communication or other type of social science background. We're typically not lawyers because lawyers are typically not trained in the sort of things that we study in graduate school. There are some who come from an acting background or a marketing background. So that's typically where we come from. I come from it from a psychology background. Primarily, you're looking at cognitive psychology, social psychology. Those types of principles are what I try to apply to the work. And then, you know, the other thing that sort of sets us apart is experience level. I see way more juries than lawyers do because I don't have to spend 2 years working up a case. So I'll pick 2, 3, 4 juries a month and do as many focus groups a month. And so, you know, over time and over, you know, over the years, you have that sort of academic base that gets supplemented with experience. And kind of going to what Ben was saying, I think it's interesting. We started out as jury consultants, then we kind of moved to trial consultants, and then we moved to litigation consultants in terms of defining our role. And that's because there really is more than just helping with a jury, because there you can get help with arbitrations, you can get help with mediations, you can get help in cases where you're not going to trial at all. And so it really is become more broad over the years in terms of what people in my profession tend to do.
So talking about your exposure, when you're in all of these different jury selections, us as human beings in our home lives, spend time with our family, spend time with our friends, and probably don't spend a lot of time talking to strangers. And so when you're picking juries or involved in jury selections all across the country, you get to see people of all walks of life, states of mind, belief systems. How does that help you? And how does that help, you know, you in taking that information and learning and understanding about how people and how they tick?
I think the most important thing is to recognize that you really can't judge a book by its cover. You know, within the law, there are a lot of stereotypes about, I want women on this case, or I want this, you know, this racial minority is good, or this one is bad. And I think the most important thing for me has been really listening to the words that come out of people's mouths and really understanding the idea that experience, personal life experience, trumps general attitudes, trumps demographics in terms of how someone is going to view any given case. So, you know, over the years, you do see certain themes. You know, in a motorcycle case, you've got certain themes that are people who are going to be one way or another. In a products case, there are certain attitudes that pop up that tell me that you're going to be a defense juror versus a plaintiff juror. So you do develop sort of trends in terms of words that come out of people's mouths that are cues to me in terms of how they're going to interpret the case. But I think the most important thing really is to actively listen and not just assume because someone looks a certain way or even because they have a certain job that they're going to see the case this way as opposed to another way. So it's interesting because on the one hand, yes, the more you see, the more you can sort of generalize in terms of attitudes. But at the same time, you always have to remember that it needs to each time come down to an individual assessment of the particular juror that you're talking to.
One of the challenges I've found is that we do a lot of focus group work, and one of the little, games we play is that all the lawyers and staff that are involved in doing the focus groups, we always try to predict how the jurors are going to decide the case based on the answers they give to our focus group voir dire. And I can tell you, I'm particularly terrible at that. I look at somebody and they've given me a good answer to something, or they answered the specific question I thought was going to be the one, whether it's on non-economic damages. I know you don't like that term, but that kind of thing, pain and suffering, or some other question that's designed to distinguish good and bad. And I find it's no better than a coin flip. What advice do you have for people in picking a jury on how to identify good and bad jurors for your case?
So it's very case specific, although I have to say the response to non-economic damages is almost always a decider for me. I always say I don't call it non-economic because no one knows what that is. But I do say emotional distress because I think that's like a trigger for tort reform people to talk about money for emotional distress or loss of enjoyment of life. It really brings out the people who think that's silly. And so I do like to ask that question, but it is very case specific, Ben, in terms of I don't have a magic bullet question other than sort of that non-economic damages question in terms of who I'm going to deselect. But what I'm really looking, and I think that's the key in all of this, is to remember that it's deselection. So I'm looking for people who are bad. You know, I am not there trying to find good jurors. I'm trying to hide the good jurors. And so through the process, when we do it, and I'll say for focus groups, I don't do jury selection. I mean, we don't do voir dire. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But in actual jury selection, the focus going in when I'm working with clients is let's figure out what the three problems with our case are. And let's kind of put those out there and see who lights up. And so I'm looking at people who straight out of the box tell me, I don't think you should get money for loss of enjoyment of life. My brother's a vet and he lost a leg and he didn't get anything. And this is a bunch of crap. And this is just all lawyer driven. So I know that juror is probably going to be closed off to my case. I'm not looking for the juror who's, oh yeah, that sounds good. Tell me more. I mean, that's great. I'm looking to just find the people who have problems with the case. So that's one thing. I kind of strategize it that way in that I'm looking to identify people with biases. Now, kind of flipping back to what you were saying, in states, and in California, we have pretty liberal voir dire. Now, we often get a jury questionnaire. This case I was just in, now this, it's a COVID related, but it took us 4 weeks to pick this jury. It's like the old death penalty days in terms of how long it's taking now. But in states where you don't have a lot of voir dire, or like in federal court, your strategy is exactly right. That's when you want to do a lot of focus groups, because you need to be able to sell your case to the broadest audience, right? If you're not really able to structure your jury as much, you got to figure out, okay, I'm going to have some conservative jurors on here. I'm going to have some jurors who are going to be a little bit resistant to me from the beginning. What is going to tick with them? How can I, you know, and every case has that, right? You know, for example, you know, if there's a rules case and you get your authoritarian jurors who don't like rules to be broken. So you focus your case that way. So I think there are ways, even in states with less voir dire, where you can get benefit from having, you know, consultants come in and kind of help you frame your case.
So touching on what Ben commented upon, I think I'm really bad at that too. And I just remember this one time, Sonia and I were in Long Beach, and there was this 50-year-old engineer, worked for Raytheon, and his jury questionnaire was kind of unclear on whether he could be a fair and impartial juror or whether he was already closed-minded and against the plaintiff. And I think I went right into my own personal implicit biases. Both my parents are engineers. I think my dad loves me a lot, but would be a very conservative juror. I wouldn't even want him on my jury. And even if I called him dad during closing argument, he would probably still rule against me. But
same with my dad. Then,
right? And so I went in and I started asking this gentleman questions, really nice man. And all I heard in his responses were that, you know, I'm not on your side. But I was just hearing it through the ears that wanted to filter out the good and only hear the bad. And so Sonia finally passes me a post-it note. And by the way, when she passes post-it notes during jury selection, it's the loudest, most eventful experience you'll ever have. I think baseball stadiums are quieter than that event. And so so she slams it down and she's like, we're good. And then I look at him and I'm like, are we good? He goes, we're good. And then I just kind of went to the next juror. So that whole process of active listening to actually understand, it really starts with ourselves and making sure that we are completely open-minded and starting with a blank slate with each person we're talking to. And that's hard. Sometimes it's hard.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, we had a question. We didn't have a questionnaire. Did we have a questionnaire in that case?
I thought we did.
if we have a questionnaire, we start with sort of an initial rating. And I think while that's helpful because it tells us what we think our goal is, that goal can change midstream, which is, I think, what happened here. And it ended up that the juror had a son who I think was similarly situated to our client, which is not always good. You know, you can't just assume similarity can sometimes be really bad. But the way that he was talking about it, kind of, he was softer than we thought an engineer would be. And so, yeah, I sent a message saying Raul was actively trying to get him out on a cause challenge and he wasn't giving it because he was good for us. And so I was like, stop it. He's good. He's good. And it is sort of like exactly like he said, you see older white gentleman engineer, you're like, this guy's not going to be good for me. And that goes back to what I was saying at the very beginning is we got to see through our own implicit and explicit biases in terms of what the actual words coming out of the person's mouths are.
And what about when people are using words that sound good, but are actually masking opinions or experiences or viewpoints that are bad? And I think one of the, as I reflect on my own experience, is one reason I may not be great at distinguishing the good from bad jurors is that I like jurors who tell me what I want to hear.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's part of your own ego as a lawyer. They're making you feel good. They're giving you the answers you want. And so you feel connected to that person. But actually, those answers are kind of just the superficial responses masking what their true beliefs are underneath that. But we want to accept the answers because it makes us feel better about ourselves. So that seems like an area where it'd be valuable to have you sitting there who's and actually processing it for real rather than us accepting it at face value.
And I have a lot of clients who, you know, I'll be like, this guy's terrible. They're like, really? I think they're okay. I'm like, you would like to go have a beer with that juror. And that's great. But you don't want this juror on your jury, right? So there are those jurors who are really charismatic and we like them and they participate in voir dire. We got a little banter going, but you have to think, okay. So it's interesting. I'm talking about the words coming out of their mouths, right? And so there is sort of the way that they say it. Often if there's a questionnaire, I'll remind that people usually don't get better in court unless they've just fundamentally misunderstood something. So somebody who's got really bad answers on their questionnaire, but they come into court and they're like, yeah, you know, I thought about it. It's okay. I'm cool. You know, and they kind of send that message that they didn't really mean what they said on the questionnaire that they wrote yesterday. You know, I'm suspicious of that. And I'm suspicious of people who sort of try to be a little more neutral. I usually don't want someone who seems to be actively trying to get on a jury. Like that usually makes me nervous I say that, but I have found during COVID that people want to be on the jury because they're bored. And I am not necessarily, you know, going in with that same attitude of like, okay, if you're not trying to get out, there's something wrong with you. And why do you want to be on this jury? But it used to be sort of, if someone was sort of trying to actively be neutral, I'd be a little suspicious of it. But I think you have to be aware of your own, again, this goes back to your own internal sort of biases. And you got to think, do I just want to hang out with this juror? Because jurors can love you and side against you. Right. I mean, absolutely. They can say, you know, I really loved you, Rahul. You were so awesome. Great case. So sorry, I had to side against you. Now, the flip side, I do pay attention to if I feel like a juror is sort of actively hostile to the client, to the attorney, I definitely take that into consideration because that tells me that they've already got something going on. And it worries me unless they're actively hostile to both sides. And then that's a different story, right? So there is a sort of a body language component to it, as well as the words that come out of their mouths. And there are certain keywords I listen to, Ben, like if jurors are talking about rewards when they're talking about jury damages, that to me is a buzzword because only tort reformers call it reward. You know, there's certain words that over the years I start to listen to and help me read between the lines in terms of what the juror is actually thinking.
So in your mind, there's a potentially good juror for the plaintiff's side when they're angry all the time. So angry to both sides and just a generally salty person.
Well, not necessarily that they're a good juror, but I'm less concerned about a juror who is sort of not super friendly to either side. I just had that example where I was like, oh, I'm not sure. I feel like this juror was a little standoffish to plaintiff lawyer. And then defense lawyer got up and it was equal treatment. So it wasn't that I necessarily think they're a great juror, but I didn't then start to think they hate us. I think that's just this person's personality. And maybe, you know, and it goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning is we forget that public speaking is hard, right? Lawyers are used to it. And a lot of times these jurors haven't spoken in public for a long time in front of a group of people. And particularly during COVID, they might not have spoken to anybody in a long time. And so remembering that there is a, there's an anxiety there. There are demand characteristics of being public setting. You've got the judge kind of sending a message about what she wants the jurors to say. So there are a lot of things going on that you have to take into consideration when you're evaluating how someone is coming across in that situation.
I'm interested in nonverbal communication and also facial, I know there's quite a new development now on facial recognition features, and there's even, I guess algorithms or software programs that can help you if you're able to capture people by video and with remote jury selection, that might be more of an option. But can you talk about that those two elements?
Yeah. So I don't, you know, there is a whole industry on micro expressions and, you know, I've attended a couple of seminars on it. I don't use that. What I am looking for is a little bit more general. It's the subtle nod when Ben's talking and I'm over there going, yep. Or I'm going, Jesus, what is he saying? Right. You know, it's, so I'm looking more at things like arms crossed, nodding, disinterest, super interest. There is a whole industry, like I said, beyond that micro expressions. I find it really hard. I mean, it's very hard to look at all the jurors during jury selection. I'm primarily looking at the juror who's speaking, and it's always good to have more than one set of eyes there. So you can have some juror, you know, somebody with your team kind of looking at the people in the back of the room to see and to listen, because sometimes jurors will just say like, oh my God, that's ridiculous. So I like to have a bit of a team there to help me look, but it's not actually practical to do any type of, you know, micro expression analysis during jury selection. I don't think. I think that's more on the science fiction side of it in terms of what I actually do. Like maybe they do that on Bull, but I don't do that in real life.
So what other types of new age jury profiling things are out there that you've heard of?
Well, I don't know if I call it new age, but what's really popular right now is the big data. So I mostly do traditional mock trials, focus groups. Now we've moved them online over the last year, and I'll talk about that in a little bit and why I really like that. But I think what's sort of new is they call them online focus groups, which irritates me because in my mind, a focus group involves deliberation and discussion. So they're really more of surveys, but they're helpful. And so I think that's the new kind of trend, is to do basically a case survey. And I know they've been around forever. You know, people have been doing case surveys forever, but I think they're recently kind of coming back into vogue. The idea of you present a case summary and sort of plaintiff side, defense side to 200 people, 300 people, and get their reaction to it, their verdict, and maybe a damage amount. And then you can say, okay, now it's not predictive, but I think with 200, 300 people, especially for damages, I think you can get a nice range. You can figure out if you're asking for way too much or too little. And you can get some help for jury selection, but again, in my experience, most of the jury selection information that comes out of that is demographic, and I don't like to make my decisions based on demographics. I think those surveys work best when you are collaborating with whoever's going to be doing the jury selection. That way you can get some of those questions on there that I think are more helpful, as opposed to just male, female, old, young, you know, rich, poor. But I think that's something that is becoming way more popular, and I like it. I like the big data surveys. I think they're helpful in collaboration with other case strategies. So I think that one's new. What else? Can you think of other, I don't know about other new agey stuff that's there.
What about mining social media and that sort of thing?
We've been doing that forever, right? So social media has been, you know, we've been looking at that for a long time. We typically, as soon as we get the jury list, send it back to the office and get the associates working on, you know, they're better at it than we are in terms of looking that stuff up. It's a needle in a haystack exercise. You get a lot of not relevant information, but sometimes you get gold mines. Recent case I was just doing, this guy, if you looked at him, you'd be like, oh my gosh, he's super scary. You know, he doesn't fit our profile demographically or any other way. And he was a little bit standoffish. His social media page, his Facebook page was as like far left as it comes, right? I mean, you couldn't get more left. And so I reevaluated him completely based on his, I mean, I was like, I not only want to be friends with this guy, he's like going to be the four person and he's super strong and all of these characteristics. There were some racial elements in the case and he had all this Black Lives Matter stuff. So never in a million years would have known that had we not done the social media research. So it doesn't hurt and it can often help, right?
So with those surveys, what I've seen at least is there's a lot of different vendors out there, but it seems like it has the potential to be a very valuable tool when used in the right way. And it also could be garbage in, garbage out.
100%.
Yeah.
And that's why I was saying, I think it's really effective when the person creating it has to be realistic in terms, you know, I've read somewhere I'm like, yeah, this is great, but there's no way the defense is going to present the argument this way. Right. So it has to be realistic in terms of what the stimulus material are in order for you to have confidence in the results. And I think the other thing is a lot of times I don't think the clients know where these people come from. Now, if they're using like Amazon Mechanical Turk, I don't know that that's representative of your specific county and your specific venue. You know, they don't pay very much to complete these surveys. I think it's maybe $8 to $10 a person in some of these, right? Versus when we're doing focus groups, we're typically paying between $200 and $300 for the session. And so I feel like you know a little bit more about what you're getting. So it is absolutely garbage in, garbage out. So if you're going to do that, you want to ask questions about who are the respondents. You want to make sure that you have an active hand in crafting the case summary so that it's realistic in terms of both what you would present, what you'd be allowed to present, and what the defense presentation is likely to be like. Because I've seen somewhere, I'm like, wow, there's no way the defense would say that. Because especially if like, we know this defense lawyer, and I know there's no way that he or she would ever go there. Or, you know, this one comment was super offensive and that skewed the whole results because of something that was said in the scripting. So I think you just need to be careful in terms of the scripting. But again, yes, can be very valuable if done right. And there are people out there who do it really, really well.
You mentioned race. Can you comment on how important race is as a predictor, or does that depend on the venue or the specific case?
So I think race is the number one sort of stereotype that I have to battle my clients with every single day in terms of, you know, plaintiff lawyers have a perception, X jurors are good for me, bad jurors, you know, X jurors are bad, Y jurors are bad for me. And it is a constant struggle where there's a sort of a shutdown. I'm not going to listen to what this juror said. Rahul knows I battle this all the time with good, very, very good lawyers, and they're coming around, you know, they're coming around, but it's a constant reminder of like, no, listen to the words that are coming out of their mouths. I think the only time where race is a valuable indicator to think about is if there are racial elements in the case. So police misconduct cases or employment discrimination cases. Why? Because it's really about experience. It's not about race at that point, right? So if someone is more likely to have experienced discrimination, harassment, racial profiling, then that is a different, you know, sort of set of circumstances that they come to the case with, as opposed to just assuming that someone of a particular, race or ethnicity likes or doesn't like a personal injury case. Now, there is sort of
Does it depend on if the claimant is what race the claimant is?
I think so. You know, I think that's something that you want to bear in mind, but not necessarily. This goes back to the idea of you can't say you have a Black client. You can't assume, all the Black jurors are going to be good, right? And I've actively seen exactly the opposite, right? So there's something that, you know, there's a whole psychology behind similarity liking and similarity rejection. And it's what's known as the black sheep effect. And the idea being that if somebody is on your jury and they're very similar to your client, they can actually be the worst juror for you, right? Because they want to, it's cognitive dissonance. This wouldn't happen to me, and here's why. And then all of a sudden they become a leader. They can, let's say it's a case where your client is of a certain race or ethnicity, let's say African-American client, African-American juror, who then kind of like denigrates your client, maybe says something that's kind of subtly racist, then that gives permission to everybody else to do it too. So I think you have to be careful in making assumptions about similarity. Oftentimes, you know, especially, I think this is especially true in employment cases where you have a juror who you think, oh, this juror was mistreated at work, they're going to be great for us. But they're not, because they're like, look, I wouldn't have stood for this, or I went to HR sooner, or I did X, Y, and Z, or in cases, you know, personal injury cases, all the ways that I could have avoided having this injury happen to me. So oftentimes the juror who's the most similar is problematic. But I do think, you know, going back to race and gender, I do think the other side makes defense makes decisions on it all the time. So we are always prepared to do a Batson Wheeler. It's Wheeler in California, but we are always prepared to do a Batson challenge. We've had them successfully granted and had the juror reseated, which is just devastating, especially when it's done in open court. So we feel very strongly about not making decisions based on race or gender and try to call other people out when they do.
Without naming names, Sonia and I were speaking on a panel in Orlando on jury selection, and actually did a little mock voir dire there too. And there was a criminal lawyer who was on the panel with us. And this lawyer just was open and unabashed about saying that he picks jurors and kicks people off based on race.
Yeah.
And both Sonia and me had a visceral reaction and just, you know, we're open and saying, first of all, that's just not appropriate. And second, it's not even helpful. So you're not actually learning about these jurors and what each human being has in their belief system when you do something like that, besides it being unethical.
And illegal. I mean, frankly,
yeah. Yeah. But it's so interesting. And that was on the criminal side. But I think that I don't spend a lot of time on criminal, but it seems like that's a pervasive practice among prosecutors to do just that.
Yeah. I mean, that's where all the Batson, you know, case law comes from, is from criminal. And so it is a long history of prosecutors striking racial minorities from juries based solely on race. And so that's where, you know, that is where most of the case law comes from. Absolutely. I think it's still a common practice. I mean, again, both in criminal and civil, I think it's a common practice that you can count on it. And sometimes, you know, to our benefit, sometimes I think the other side is so embroiled in stereotype. Will there be a juror that I'm like, this juror is actually really good for us, and they're going to leave her on because of her ethnicity and or occupation, right? So sometimes we get a win because of their stereotypes, or vice versa. You know, they're going to kick somebody because of a stereotype, and I typically know what those stereotypes are and usually act on them.
What's your take on a lawyer, and I've seen this, but we raise a Batson Wheeler challenge because they clearly exercised a peremptory and tried to excuse a juror based on race or gender. And then that lawyer comfortably opens up their notepad and has their pre-printed out sheet of all the different case law on all the different justifiable reasons to excuse that juror. And they just kind of go down the list and like, I pick case law number 4, and here's the reason why I excuse this person to justify their behavior. And this is actually the question, really not a legal question. Doesn't that say more about the lawyer than it does about?
It usually means that they've been up against us before and know it's coming. Because most of the time we hear, I'm not a racist, I have many Black friends. You know, that's usually the response that we get. But yeah, there are those lawyers who come and they're like, oh, well, I have all these reasons. And it's the sort of thing that is non-verifiable demeanor. I didn't like the way they answered the question. You know, they were avoiding eye contact with me, the sort of thing that you can't really prove. It does say more about the lawyer. If they're coming prepared to defend their race-based challenge, I have concerns with that. On the other hand, if they actually, and I try not to make them frivolously, right? You know, there's some lawyers who say, well, look, they kicked this person. I'm like, they kicked this person because they said X, Y, and Z. That's a race-neutral reason. It really is when there's absolute no race-neutral reason or gender-neutral reason. A recent case where I started noticing that the defense lawyer was only asking women of color about sympathy. And it was systematic, right? You know, and this court of, well, don't you think you're going to feel too sympathetic? Don't you think, and, you know, some of them were like, you know, tax collector, you know, they weren't necessarily like people who had jobs that would make them sympathetic. And it became really apparent to me that that was going on, and just start noting it down, right? So it happens a lot. And sometimes it's as subtle as that. And there's often, I think the one thing you have to be prepared for is proxy explanations. And that is the, well, she's a caretaker. that's proxy for gender, right? And so you want to look for comparators. I think that's what, in times that we've been successful in our bets and challenges, it's been when we've been able to show a comparator. And that's what really Supreme Court under Miller L was focusing on, is the, okay, well, there's a man who has the exact same occupation. You know, there's a male nurse who you didn't kick off, or there is a woman who has the same life experience, or a, you know, a white person who has the same life experience as the Black juror that you kicked off.
Can you talk a little bit about regional differences? I mean, I'm in the state of Maine. I try cases all over northern New England, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. I had a very eye-opening experience last year because I had a significant case that was going to trial in Detroit. So I was there doing focus groups, and the jury pool in downtown Detroit was so different. And, you know, to be direct about it, racially completely different from what I see here in northern New England. It was so different that the same answers or expressions people may give there meant something different than what the same statement might mean here. And the results and the way they valued the claimant's damages and just the way they valued and approached the case was so different. And I wonder how you account for those regional differences when you're advising clients.
Yeah, I think that's the importance of doing focus group research in the venue where you're going to be trying the case, because even though we do cases all over the country, I've not been in every single venue. And I think it's important not only to test the venue, but to test the moment in time, you know, right? Because life, you know, what's happening in the world affects the way that people see things. So it's sort of a venue, it's a specific to location, because of whatever your life experiences are in Detroit are different than what your life experiences are in Maine in terms of everything, not just sort of racial diversity, but economic diversity, environment, all those other things factor into sort of how people see the world. And I think sort of both location and time, because current events factor in. And Rahul and I just recently were talking about that in a case where we had a case involving a hedge fund manager. And long ago, we were trying this case and it was involved a beat down. And it was at the same time that they had drugged that guy off the airplane. And we redid a CLE on it. And it was at the same time where the GameStop, like the whole hedge fund thing, was in the news. So really thinking about what's going on in current events, as well as location, is important. So I think, you know, the short answer to your question is, I think it's always beneficial to do research in the venue where you're trying the case, which kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about those surveys, is I don't want a nationwide survey. I want reactions from people in the venue where I'm going to be trying the case.
So we're going to take a brief 30-second break to recognize our sponsors, and then we'll be back right after that.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Expert Institute. Not only will they find you testifying experts for your case, but they also offer an entire staff of in-house experts to help you strategize and prepare your case each step of the way. Go to expertinstitute.com/elevate, and you'll get a 25% discount for our listeners for your first expert engagement. Our show is also brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is the top-rated legal case management software in the market. It's simple enough for the smallest practices and robust enough for the largest class action and multi-district litigation firms. Go to smartadvocate.com and again, ask for the discount available to the listeners of the Elevate podcast. Our show today is also brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a boutique digital marketing firm for law firms. If you're feeling like you're in a digital marketing rut, perhaps you're tired of your old website, seeking something better, I would encourage you to talk to Tyler and Micah at Hype Legal. Tyler and Micah have been working in the legal space for 27 years combined. They both worked at High Impact, which is a firm that provides national trial graphics to lawyers, where they built out a highly successful marketing and digital platform for that company. Now they've started their own company to be a boutique marketing and design firm for high-end trial lawyers. I've worked with both Micah and Tyler for a long time, for Tyler for over a decade. They're incredibly professional, responsive, and have a real genius for aesthetics, design, and marketing. They designed our Elevate website and all of our graphics, which I think is really fantastic. Give them a call and check them out at HypeLegal, HypeLegal.com.
Sonia, so one of the things, just you're never going to pat yourself on the back, so I'm just going to do a little bit for you. You've selected juries in the talc cases across the country. You've done the roundup cases. You've done a lot of cases with our firms, a lot of high profile cases and cases that are all righteous cases, and had the opportunity to have a fair and impartial jury and result in significant recoveries for a lot of victims. I think that really is a testament to a lot of the great work you do and the science behind what you do as well. You've also been involved in a lot of criminal trials, and you've been doing this for a while, where we've now got a lot of in-person juries across the country. We've hit the pandemic. There's been the pivot to doing things remotely, whether that be through focus groups or even remote jury selection, and now reverting back to in-person jury selection with masking. Some of the masks are clear masks. Some of the masks are opaque. What works? What doesn't? Because us as trial lawyers, and I've seen this, especially when people are a little bit more old school, they think there's only one way to do it, and it's the way that it was done for the years that they've been practicing as a lawyer. But this time has forced a lot of us to be introspective in trying to figure out what else could work. In your experience so far, what do you think? What works? What doesn't work? What are the benefits and what are the problems with trying different things?
So I have not yet done an online trial. I'm trailing on two. So I'm probably going to, I'm hopefully, fingers crossed, going to be doing an online jury selection and trial here in the coming weeks. I've done two in-person jury selections during lockdown, during COVID. And I've done a lot of online mock trials. And one of the things, when we first started the online mock trial, even I was reluctant. I was kind of old school and used to doing them in person. And I'm like, this is going to be weird. It's not going to be the same. And I have to say, after a year of doing it, one of the things I really like about it is I actually feel like the mock jurors are paying more attention because there's nowhere to hide. You know, their face is right there. And if somebody is not paying attention or they're sleeping, you can call them and kick them out, you know, and I just remove them, as opposed to in the focus group facility, you know, there's 40 people in a room and somebody's sleeping in the back and, you know, you can't really reach them and you don't really know what's going on. So they're all right in your face. And the other thing that I absolutely love is you're seeing into their lives, right? You know, like, what is their background? What are they, you know, I got a guy who's like sitting on a bed with a bunch of unfolded clothes versus somebody who is like in an office and dressed a certain way. It really is another glimpse into who this person is. So I've really enjoyed the online research, the sort of the mock trials and the focus groups. We have done a couple of mock jury selections, both through ABOTA and with Nevada Justice Association. And I think it's absolutely viable to do a remote jury selection. I think the challenges really are technology challenges in terms of being able to keep the jurors pinned in order so you can see everyone. But I think you can actually see more jurors in that format than you can in, particularly in a socially distanced in-court jury selection. Of, like I said, I've done two of those and the jurors are all throughout the gallery. There's like four in the jury box, six on the right side, six on the left side. And it's impossible to see the jurors when you're doing the jury selection without kind of having your head on a swivel. So I think it's possible. I think I know that in Alameda County, where I live, they have done a number of Zoom trials. I've talked to a couple of lawyers who have done the jury selection and they thought it went just fine. They liked it. I mean, I think the big concern that a lot of people have had is access to technology. And is that going to skew the pool? And is it going to skew the pool in a way that's detrimental to one side or the other? And so I think that if you're doing that, you have to be really mindful of requesting that the court provide technology, sort of like they've been doing in the schools, where if certain, you know, children don't have access to a laptop or to an internet connection, that you make that available. So that would be my one concern with it. But I kind of, going back to what you're saying, Rahul, a lot of clients are super opposed to it. And they're just, we're not doing it. We'd rather wait 2 years to get a trial date than to do a Zoom trial. And I think that's unfortunate.
Have you noticed that any jurors, when they're in a remote setting, even prospective jurors during these mock jury selections, that they have a tendency to be less open or more open?
Yeah, I actually think they're more open, and it's because of the comfort level that we were talking about before, the sort of intimidation factor in the courtroom, a public speaking in front of a bunch of people. You know, it's easier to just have a conversation in your own room, in your own home, where you're comfortable. You have less of those demand characteristics. So I actually think that I think it's less intimidating and people are more likely to sort of say what's on their mind when they're at home. I know the other sort of thing that people worry about, and I do run into this, is the distraction factor, right? You know, kid running in, dog jumping on the lap. You know, I think we've all experienced that over the last year. So I think that is a factor, but I don't think it's any different than the juror falling asleep in court or, you know, kind of checking their phone on the side. I think that distraction happens both live and at home.
You talked before about helping lawyers develop the themes and framework for presenting the case beyond just choosing the jury. Could you tell us a little bit about your process for that and whether you're seeing any trends or themes that are kind of emerging in the last couple of years, or particularly COVID times?
Yeah, so I typically focus on framing the case when I'm talking about themes. I think there is a tendency, you know, for a long time there was a tendency in the plaintiff's bar to really focus the case on the client and to start with, you know, look how wonderful my injured client is. And for, you know, 5, 10 years or more, we've really shifted that and really want the focus to be on the bad actor, on the person who caused the injury, the idea that this could have happened to anyone. And that's primarily because of the tendency to blame a victim, the tendency to want to believe that something negative can't happen to us. So I work a lot with lawyers in terms of framing the case. Where does the case start? I like to start oftentimes at sort of the inception of the choice, you know, whatever that may be, you know, that where the decision was made that sort of set the dominoes in action. So I work a lot with lawyers in terms of that, and we like to test it. So we come up with some themes, we do some brainstorming, we do some theming, and then test it in a focus group, see what resonates, see what doesn't resonate. Other things that when I talk about framing, it's not just where you start the story, it's how you tell it, particularly in terms of damages. There's a tendency that, lawyers want to, this is another buzzword. When I hear jurors say, make whole, that's not good. That's not good for plaintiffs, because make whole, when you have a client who doesn't make very much money, means, well, $1 million is going to be a lot for someone like her. So I don't like to structure damages in terms of make whole. It's sort of what, you know, instead it's the bag of money argument, right? How much would you give up to have this happen to you? And there's a lot of psychological research on how people interpret things, you know, anchoring, adjustment, loss versus gain, that I like to try and bring in when coming up with the story of a case. Now, in your question about sort of themes over the last year, one of the things that I've noticed is, and it's interesting, I work with another woman who does primarily commercial cases, and I help her out and help facilitate groups with her, and she does for me occasionally. And she was telling me that over the last year, she always gives a neutral statement at the beginning and has jurors sort of say, even with this neutral statement, which way are you leaning? And she has come out in the last year, she said, usually it's 50-50, right? 50 plaintiff, 50 defense. And these are typically patent cases or contract cases, but they're involving corporations. And she said in the last year, it's been like 75-25, the defendant did something wrong after the neutral statement. So I think there is this a shift, I think, towards believing that corporations are bad actors in a way that, that really came about over, and I don't think it's just pandemic. I think it's Trump plus pandemic, but I think in the last kind of couple of years, there's been that shift. So that is one trend that I'm seeing. And you know, there was a lot of concern that people would be, less generous because of their own misfortune. And I have found, I think, the opposite to be true, that I think there is more empathy amongst jurors now. And then the other thing that I find really, really interesting is that while COVID is so prominent, and I mean, obviously it's so prominent in all of our lives, I have not heard any jurors talking about it other than in hardship. You know, it has not come up in any of our focus groups. It has not come up in any of the jury selection responses. So it's interesting. It's like this overhanging thing that's around, but nobody is really talking about it in terms of how it's affecting their decision. I'm sure that it is, but it's not been overt, which I think is really interesting.
Have there been any direct questions of the prospective jurors about COVID?
Only in terms of hardship. You know, and I have done, so in my own focus group research from the beginning, on our background questionnaires, we started including questions about masking and about, you know, how good of, one of the questions that I did in that case with Brian in San Bernardino, the most interesting question was actually a question the defense put on there. And it was so helpful to us. And it was when Trump was still president. And the question was, how good of a job do you think that President Trump has done with COVID? And there were literally people who said, excellent. You know, so we were looking at the jurors who said he's done an excellent job or very good job. And then we had questions on there about mask mandates, if they were in agreement with them or in disagreement with them. So that told us about their politics for sure. Right. And so we did get some information from the jurors on that. So only, but yes, when direct questions are asked, we are getting information from it. And the same within our focus groups, I started tracking attitudes towards COVID and again, more towards the political nature of it. I found that it was fairly predictive in terms of jurors who were more conservative were the ones who were like, this isn't real. We shouldn't be wearing masks. We need to reopen, as you would expect. But in terms of them actively bringing up anything related to COVID in either focus group deliberations or in jury selection, I haven't heard anything.
That is so interesting. Do you think that means that it has no impact or that they just don't want to talk about it?
I think they just don't want to talk about it, right? I mean, I think it's one other thing that came up the other day was I had a case and it was important that the sort of the structure of the case, it was happening around 2008 and this was involving sort of construction. And it was really important to remember the context of the housing crisis and the recession. And our mock jurors just weren't even remembering that, right? And it's sort of like this current crisis has so erased the prior crisis that we had to really bring the jurors back there and say, okay, remember 2008 with images and pictures. We had to show, you know, like halted construction and things to really kind of viscerally get the jurors back there because it's sort of like all those things in the past are gone. Well, now we're just dealing with the crisis that's in front of us. It has to affect how people are viewing things, but I think it's sort of, we're all just sick of it and nobody wants to talk about it anymore.
For those in venues with limited opportunity for voir dire, you've already touched on this a little bit, but if you could only ask, say, 1 to 3 questions that were pretty targeted, what questions would you ask and how would you assimilate the answers to help you decide who would be a good plaintiff's juror?
Yeah. So like I said before, probably my number one question is, what are your thoughts about the idea or concept of awarding money for loss of enjoyment of life and emotional distress? And I like to ask it that way because I don't want jurors to say, well, I want to hear the evidence. I'm looking for people who are just opposed to the whole idea or concept of money for that particular category. And it's either non-economic or in wrongful death, the same. I would read the elements of the case and really focus on, is there any one of these elements that you feel like you would not be willing to give money for? I also, if I'm in a venue where the judge is allowing us to say an amount, I get reaction to that amount. I want to find the jurors who like, I don't care what you show me. I'm never going to give you that amount of money. And then the rest of it is, you know, my third one would always be case specific, right? Because I ask a different question in a motorcycle case than I do in a drowning case, than I do in a product case. So it would be something related to liability in terms of what my third question would be. We are very heavily focused on damages questions in our voir dire. And it kind of has twofold. And number one, we really want to get people used to the big money, accustomed to it, not afraid of it. We're judging who has a visceral reaction to large numbers when we ask for them. And then the end result being, most of the time, if things go our way, the jurors who remain on the panel are the ones who are like, yeah, okay, I could give $40 million if the evidence supported it. And so it's sort of a idea that it's interesting. I've had cases where, you know, there's a, you know, mistrial midway through and the jurors talk to them afterwards. They're like, we actually thought that this was only about damages, right? Like there's an assumption that liability is a foregone conclusion if you are spending a lot of your voir dire talking about damages, because that's where the juror, again, you kind of frame the argument to where you want the jurors to go. And I think that that can sometimes happen if you're talking mostly about damages in your voir dire, which doesn't necessarily go to your question of what to do in limited voir dire jurisdictions. But I think my usual answer is those non-economic damages, I think, are the best identifiers of tort reform jurors. I don't like to ask who thinks there's too many lawsuits or that verdicts are too high, because everybody says that, right? I find now that when you say who thinks there's too many lawsuits, the three best jurors are the ones who don't raise their hand. Everybody else raises their hand. So to me, that's turned into an identifier for the defense. And so that's why I like to go with the more extreme, you have a cap right now, you couldn't go over, and the reaction to the non-economic damages.
And just to follow up on that, what you get in response to that, we do that a lot, that question about lost enjoyment or emotional distress, yeah. A lot of responses are depends.
Yeah.
Right? So you don't think that's a problem. It's only the people who respond that I don't believe it's appropriate, or I would not consider that, those people you would have a problem with. But if it's somebody who says, just depends on the facts of the case, you would never.
No, I don't like to let them go with that. Because I think depends is a suspicious answer. I think it's sometimes an answer. It could be an answer. Okay, well, let's put it this way. Let's say it's a kid who's never thought about it before in their life. Then I'm fine with it. But if it's someone who you think has probably considered this before, and they say, well, it depends on the evidence, that's a non-answer. And so I always have my clients dig deeper and say, I get that you want to see the evidence, but tell me your thought, and not, are you okay with it or not okay with it? I never want to give them a yes or no option. What do you think of the idea or concept of it? Just the concept of somebody getting money for this, right? So I like to dig deeper and really make them. And then the other thing that you often hear, I'm sure, Ben, is like, well, it's really hard to put a price on it. And so for that, it is hard to put a price on it. That to me is not necessarily you're no good. I like to say, okay, so I get it. It is hard to put a price on it. There's two schools of thought. It's too hard to put a price on it. It's too subjective. We shouldn't put price on it. And I'm not going to put a price on it. Or it's really hard to put a price on it, but I'm totally open to the concept and something I'd be willing to do. Where are you on that dichotomy, right? So kind of drilling down and figuring out where they are. Because again, just saying, well, it's hard to put a dollar value on it, that's not necessarily, that's true, right? That's not necessarily a game changer, it's over for me. But in terms of how they talk about it a little more deeply is what I'm usually looking for.
And just to, that's really helpful. Thank you. That clarifies that a lot for me. And one other thing you said was that you would ask questions about a dollar amount that you might be asking for in the case. I've heard two schools of thought on that. One is that focusing too much on the damages during voir dire emphasizes your client more than you want to at the beginning of the case, because the philosophy is you really want to focus on the conduct of the defendant. So how do you square those two ideas of having such a damages-oriented voir dire, but yet wanting to precondition or get the jury in the right frame of mind to be thinking of the case really from the perspective of the wrongdoing of the defendant?
Yeah, great point. And I think it comes down to the fact that our philosophy is that you're not selling your case doesn't start in voir dire. You know, we are not selling the case in voir dire. My experience has been jurors don't really remember jury selection. You know, once opening starts, once the evidence starts, they typically don't remember what happened in jury selection. So I think it's a mistake to spend time trying to condition or trying to educate in jury selection, because I don't think it's effective. So our approach, and you know, out here in California, we have mini openings. In our mini openings, we're bringing out things that we're worried about, right? We're not, you know, we're kind of like, we're really viewing it as an introduction to voir dire, and our voir dire is focused on our concerns and not on our strengths. Because the more we focus on the defense in our voir dire, the more likely we are to expose good jurors. We're more likely to expose people who are like, yeah, I've already decided that, you know, I feel like I'm already leaning in your favor, Mr. Gideon, because of, you know, clearly this bad company did something wrong. And so we really are not focusing on the defense much at all. If we are, we do focus on liability, but it's on the idea of, you know, personal responsibility, or the idea of, you know, you take a risk when you enter into the situation, or they signed a waiver, or whatever it may be, whatever it may be, where our concerns are with liability, that's where we're focusing instead of on bad acts of the defendant in voir dire.
Just changing topics a little bit. We talked about this yesterday, Sonia, and I want everybody to hear this. Little known fact about you. So you've spoken to the media about various issues relating to jury trials. Can you share with everybody this little known fact?
Which fact was this?
Come on. Come on. How Canadian are you?
Oh, yes. So I am the Canadian jury expert, which is super funny because I am not Canadian. And so I went to grad school in Canada and I was studying juries when I was there. I specifically went to Simon Fraser University to work with Professor Jim Ogloff, who was studying comprehension of jury instructions. And my dissertation there was on juror stress. So when I was in grad school, it was, you know, it was right after the National Center for State Courts had in the U.S. had done a bunch of research on juror stress coming off of some high profile trials, not least of which the OJ trial, and finding that, you know, certain types of trials are really stressful for jurors. And what I learned when I was in Canada, which is super interesting, is that even after the trial's over, the jurors are not allowed to talk about the deliberations ever with their spouse, with a counselor, with anyone. And so I thought, okay, we know that one of the things that helps reduce stress is talking about it, right? Social support and being able to debrief about it. So that was what my dissertation research was. I did interviews with about 100 Canadian jurors who had all experienced pretty extreme levels of stress from serving on trials there, some of which had like post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. So long story short, I became the Canadian juror stress expert. I testified in front of their parliament a couple of years ago about juror stress. And anytime there's a major trial, I get called by a Canadian radio station. So with the Chauvin trial, I got a bunch of calls about, you know, what are the jurors thinking? What about the stress of this particular type of case? So yes, that's a little known fact is that I am not Canadian. I am from Kansas, but I am the Canadian jury expert.
Just curiously, how did you get into this business? I mean, we don't need to go through a blow by blow bio, but, you know, it is kind of a unique niche.
It is. Yeah. And so I was a psychology undergrad and I wanted to do something applied. I knew that. I didn't really know about this industry. You know, I don't want to date myself, but this was back in the day, right? 93. When I was an undergrad, I was graduating and I had attended a couple of psychology and law seminars. There was a summer seminar and I learned about this field and happened to be, again, I grew up in Kansas and University of Kansas at the time was doing this special studies degree where there were three professors really interested in the profession. And one was in political science, one was in communication, one was in psychology, and they created this litigation sciences master's program. And so I was like, okay, that sounds awesome. So I really just sort of fell into it. And then from there, one of the professors, of course, started, you know, student labor, started their own, you know, had their own firm, and a bunch of us went to work there. And, you know, sort of the rest is history. I did really just fall into it and love it. You know, I've been doing it over 20 years now.
It really is fascinating. I mean, just the idea of the way jurors make decisions as a group. And I'm interested in your thoughts about that, kind of the sociology or the psychology of small group decision-making with the jury and the role of particular individuals and leaders as well, and how you go about identifying and deciding if you want someone on your jury who may be a leader in that room.
Yeah, it's super important to think about group dynamics when you're making your jury selection decisions. And we incorporate that into our rating scale. So, you know, a juror who's a one is bad and a leader. And we'll leave twos on, right? I'll leave on a juror who's bad, but who, for whatever reason, either they seem shy, they seem like they have trouble communicating, or they're crazy, right? Like sometimes a juror who's just crazy and nobody's going to listen to them, I'll leave them on over the one who's making everybody laugh, who's, you know, everybody wants to go have lunch with, who's out in the hallway being friends with everyone. So we were talking earlier about sort of nonverbals and body language. I do like to watch the jurors at lunch and in the hall and see. So you have your leaders who are on paper leaders. You know, I supervise 20 people, or I've had, you know, X, Y, and Z position. I've been on a jury before. And then you have what I call your cohesion leaders. And those are the leaders who can gather a consensus. And they're the ones who bring cookies. They're the ones who are telling jokes. They're the ones who are, you know, not afraid to speak up in front of the judge. And sometimes it's the young jurors. I think it's a mistake. I know a lot of consultants are like, oh, that's a kid. They'll never be the foreperson. 100% not true. I mean, I've had 18-year-olds be the foreperson. either because they're charismatic or because the jurors are like, this is a new experience. Maybe you should try this, right? So I think it's a mistake to discount someone because of youth or to rely too heavily on what their credentials are, because you can have someone who's, you know, very senior in a company, a senior manager, supervises 20, but they're quiet or they're an introvert or they're a nerd. You know, they're just not someone who's going to bring people with them. So I think you have to look at both the sort of on paper leadership, but also how they act in court. Who's not afraid to speak up to the judge, right? You know, again, you can have people who are just like constantly raising their hand, telling jokes. That's somebody who's a leader. And so you better be sure about your leaders is what I usually say.
So before we wrap it up, Sonia, is there any other topics you want to talk about with everybody?
I mean, one of the things we haven't yet talked about is the sort of in-person jury selection during COVID. And I think mostly, for those of you out there who are going to be engaging in that, I think the key thing is the logistics of it. You know, it's been a real shift because it has gone back to, I used to do a lot of death penalty work back in the day. And we used to do just small panels, right? You would question maybe 15 to 20 people a day. You'd question them and then you'd go like for a week and have all these panels done. And then you come back in and do your cause as you go and then do your peremptories at the end. And I think, and that's in both of the instances that I've done, that's really how it's gone back to, because until they sort of shorten the distance to 3 feet, we're still at 6 feet, you're looking at even in most courthouses, max 20, some closer to probably 12 to 14 being questioned at a time. So there is just a whole new level of logistics in terms of stamina. Even in regular times, jury selection, Raul is the worst at this. On day two, he's like, do I have to ask all these questions again? You know, and this is an instance where you're talking weeks. You're talking, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 days. So you're asking the same questions and you can't get tired. But I think the benefit of it, it's really in both instances has been like a school, right? It was like, it's like a college, because every day we come home, we debrief, we figure out what worked, what didn't work, what is the defense strategy? And then we incorporate that. We start asking the defense questions before they get up, right? We start saying, kind of stealing the thunder of where they're going to go, figuring out what they're doing for cause and restructuring the way that we're going to try and pre-rehabilitate our potential good jurors. And so while it's a slog and it's really draining, it's also super educational and interesting and being able to sort of revamp every day without the drag of having to say the same thing over and over again to the same 60 jurors who by the time you get to the back are ready to slit your throat because they've heard it so many times, right? So it's a fresh group every day, which I think has been really interesting. And then, you know, the other thing that a lot of people ask me about is the mask. And are you able to really get what the jurors are saying through the mask? And I haven't had an issue with that at all. I mean, I find they're coming through loud and clear to me. I mean, I haven't found that the mask is hindering my ability to see where the jurors are coming from. But I think one important kind of practical takeaway is for any of you who are going to in-person trial is you need to practice wearing your mask before you go. Because in both cases that I've done, it's been intense for the lawyers who are up there talking all day. We're not used to talking in that mask all day long. And in both instances, there's been some dizziness and some like, I need to go out in the hall and breathe. So it's funny, but you need to do a little dress rehearsal wearing your mask all day long while you're talking before you start trial.
Yeah, I'm always worried. I don't know if my voice will project with a mask on. So do people use microphones when they're in there?
Yeah, it's interesting because they do. The judge has been asking judges to use or the lawyers to use microphones. And what, again, it's just a practical thing. The paper masks are better. The judge that we were just with, he's like, you know, the paper mask, you can hear a lot better than you can the cloth masks. And so he's sort of recommending that you wear like the paper surgical masks are probably the best, practically speaking, in terms of being able to still hear. But it's an issue. And again, it's an issue. That was the other issue in jury selection in both instances. The jurors in the way back of the room, when they're masked, they have to come up and talk in a microphone. And so that's the other thing that's a little different. You don't have the 12 in a box or, okay, all right, Rahul, what do you think? Okay, Ben, what do you think? You know, there's a little bit less of that because there's a microphone passing situation. It's a little less spontaneous, which is another reason why it takes a little bit longer. And it's hard to hear the ones in the back. They have to come up to the front and talk. And then we were talking earlier about It's a new in person. It's a new thing to look at, right? What kind of mask are they wearing? You know, there's somebody who's double masked wearing the shield versus we had one guy who I swear it was like a sock on a shoestring that he was wearing as his mask. And so it tells you a little, you know, they're wearing it under their chin or they like super prepped up. It tells you a little bit about who they are, what their politics are. You know, we've got to see a lot of sports teams on the mask or some other messages. So it's a new cue for you to be looking at in terms of figuring out who the jurors are.
Well, Sonia, I can say for my part, this was really terrific today. I learned a ton, and I'm looking forward to implementing some of your strategies and to working with you. If our listeners want to find you, to work with you, how would they? We'll put that in our show notes. But can you tell us how we can go about finding you?
Yeah, so I can give you my email, which is schopra@choprakoonan.com. So schopra@choprakoonan.com. And my website is choprakoonan.com. So that's the easiest way to reach me. Or you can also reach out to Rahul to get my phone number.
And also she started a new project called Virtual Courtroom. And now that doing focus groups remotely is something that can be done very effectively. Sonia set up a system and a whole process, and the technology on it's fantastic through Virtual Courtroom. So you'll get her strategy advice in addition to getting a lot of not big data, small data on potential jurors and theming and preparing your case for trial. If you haven't used it, you should.
Yeah, excellent point. You know, at least out here, we're still not able to do large in-person groups. We can't do more than 12 or 14 people at a time. So we're still doing a lot of the virtual groups. And frankly, some of my lawyers don't even want to go back to in-person after the sort of the ease of being able to do it virtually and getting the same results. So yeah, absolutely. Call me for that too.
Thanks so much, Sonia. Always good talking with you. And I can't wait to see you again soon.
Thanks, guys.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.